I'm Fleur, and I'm joined by my co-host and longtime friend, Sachi. We're second career landscape designers and bring our life experience and a fresh perspective to designing gardens.
And I'm Sachi, and you're listening to the On Garden Design podcast, where we chat about what makes a garden great, and we try to inspire and make designing accessible to anyone interested in gardens. So what are we talking about today?
Well, I'm really excited today because we have a special guest, and it is Fleur Flannery.
Now, I'm surrounded by flowers.
I just need to highlight that this podcast could be confusing. There is Fleur Flannery and Fleur Froggatt, and Fleur Flannery is our guest today. And let me just introduce who she is and why she's with us before we let her tell us a lot about what we want to know. So Fleur is she's a qualified events organiser and landscape architect, extensive career experience in environmental management and urban forestation. You forgot about that, didn't you?
I do. You know, I think the nice thing about life, and I just will reflect one little thing, and also thank you very much for the introduction.
Oh, I haven't finished yet.
I'm coming to it, but you know, when I was thinking about coming here, I thought, that's so funny, having the two Fleurs. How are we going to work this out?
What about for me? It's harder for me because it's almost like a Fleur one and a Fleur two.
Exactly.
Maybe I'll call you Daisy and you Rose.
Okay.
How about that?
Right, well, let me continue. So Fleur's also the owner of Outlandish, which delivers the biennial Australian Landscape Conference and the Land Escapism events, as well as some overseas tours. So it's in this capacity that Fleur seeks to inspire the everyday gardener through to the country's best landscape designers in embracing new design thinking and practices, which is a huge undertaking, and that forms a basis of why we've invited Fleur with us today, because we want to unpack these garden design trends and this new design thinking.
So this for me is a fantastic conversation to have. So I'm going to start off with the first question to Fleur, which is, why Outlandish? What is behind your business name? Now, I'm expecting some skydiving anecdotes or something here.
It did take a while to come up with Outlandish, as simple as the word is. And, you know, borrowing from Mark Twain, if you had more time, you'd write a shorter letter. So, you know, you play with words. So what Outlandish is about is finding outstanding landscapes. And the full business name is Outlandish Ventures. So it's an adventure to find them. And it's part of my life's journey. You know, I turned 50 and my dad died about 6 years ago. And I thought, what is my epitaph? What am I doing with my life? I'd worked for the ACT government in a really great job, managing or being the director of all the open space and then strategic planning. And I felt it was time for me to do something of my own that I could be really proud of. And I could look at other people such as yourselves who are trying to innovate. And how do you get your own style? You know, when I was younger, I did a degree in landscape architecture. And to a certain extent, I got quite frightened when I finished because I thought, gosh, I'm a landscape architect now. How do I design a garden? It kind of threw me back that I should know all these things. Whereas I think if I look at myself as a, you know, where I am now with my career and my life, I think about the skills that I have and what I would tell my 20-year-old self and say, stick with it. And, you know, it's the Australian Open at the moment and I watch those wonderful women play tennis till the wee hours. And it was like, stick with it. Stick with the things that you love. And so that's where Outlandish Ventures or Outlandish has come from.
Oh, that's fantastic. I like that. And yeah. I like the fact that we're all sitting here, you know, second career, doing something completely different, but back to the sort of what we love and what we really want to do.
Yeah. So I guess that leads into that question of, if your Outlandish is trying to identify outstanding landscapes, how do you go about identifying those landscapes and those landscape designers that then you want to take other people on that journey to explore further?
It's a really great question because it's what I spend a lot of time doing. And it's about looking back, like reading and reading and reading about, you know, where do gardens come from? Why are they important? Why do we do them? Why have we done them for thousands of years? And how have they changed from, say, something like a Persian garden into a modernist garden? One of my lecturers, Professor Ken Taylor, he really just excited my brain. And I think as a person that's You know, when you feel your whole body being moved by something because you see something, a thread in it that's uniquely different, that something that someone has come up with, and you go, wow, that's a really creative way to do that, or that's changed that dull space with lawn around the edges to something that's integrated and exciting. What's been the motivating forces? So I do travel around Australia a lot and in various parts of the world looking for people that are doing inspirational things, and it doesn't have to come at the top end. You know, as you mentioned in the introduction, that I started working in an environmental area with Greening Australia, and what I really noticed there is that there's many people that innovate. They start at all different levels, and it's about seeing that idea through or having the thread of the idea. So I don't focus on a particular trend or anything. I just have a look and think, is there unique thought in that?
I can tell you when it really struck me was, which was a real turning point for me, when I attended your last Australian Landscape Conference and you had Claude Cormier address us. And this kind of, it was kind of like this aha moment to say, oh my gosh, there's different ways of looking at landscape design. And it was so enlightening and so refreshing. And I think you absolutely nailed it. By finding people like that, that opens up our minds to say, there is no wrong or right way to see this. It's completely different shades of whatever makes you happy. And so they're the sort of people I think you're doing an amazing job finding.
Thank you. Yeah, Claude Cormier is a good one to mention because he's a conceptualist, and very sadly he died towards the end of last year. He was a Canadian landscape architect. And that was really very moving that he was able to present at the Australian Landscape Conference because he was very sick and he just found out that he'd been re-diagnosed with cancer. And so he said to me, Fleur, we're all professionals. I won't be at the Australian Landscape Conference in person, but I will be there presenting. And we had various other conversations since. So, yes, he was a great find. And you often find people who do very innovative things that don't come to landscape architecture or garden design as their first design, you know, as their first calling. Some do, some definitely do, and they work away at it. But Claude, I think he came from a science background. He lived on a farm initially and then, you know, just kept thinking about, you know, designs. And his designs really didn't include plants at all, but they were very intellectually and socially interesting. And so it is about my business, and I guess, you know, for all your listeners out there, there is no right and wrong. There are certainly things that might look better than others, and you know, what's better in one person's mind is different. But I do try to bring to the Australian audience ideas across the world and also from Australia that have their own voice and their own narrative. And I, you know, I hope I'm not cutting some of your questions, because I could seriously talk about this for a long time, because it did take me quite a while to kind of work out what my business was doing or what it, you know, what I want it to do. I do feel in Australia it's time for our own voice, and that we, you know, we have an amazing landscape, and so celebrate it through our plants, through our styles, through our backing ourselves and going, yeah, we can actually mix this up with the best in the world. You know, I want people to look to us and our gardens and our landscapes and go, I want to come to Australia because I see, you know, Australia's version of the High Line, which is not a UK, not, well, UK is building their own High Line, but is not, you know, a New York High Line. It's something that it embraces an Australian lifestyle.
Do you think we actually have Australian designers where we've got an Australian identity or trademark, because we've drawn very heavily, particularly from the UK, obviously. But is there something that is distinctly Australian that you see in design?
I was asked the other day whether you could have an Australian garden without Australian plants. So I don't know. We definitely, in my view, borrow, in terms of the gardens that I like looking at, like the very contemporary gardens, we borrow, I think, a lot from the Californians. And they, you know, I think, you know, Garrett Ekobo is a really interesting example, as along with Thomas Church. The ability to look at it at a landscape that is outside your immediate garden, to borrow those views, is something that we have, you know, definitely adopted, and we should adopt, because it means that you get the sense of space and Australia, Andrew Campbell told me this one day, that we see the furthest horizons in Australia of anywhere in the world. And to me, that stayed with me whenever I'm standing on a rock or something or looking out at the sky. I go, wow, I can see further than most other people in the world. And so that's something that I like seeing in design, where we can express something in our environment that is an Australian feature, and it could be outdoor space. Like, not all of us are lucky enough to live on a farm or anything. We often live in urban areas, but, you know, Canberra has over 1 million trees in its urban footprint, and so we should be able to embrace vegetation that's outside our own garden. And I guess your question is probably alluding to, you know, what are the kind of design trends or fashions that could be described as Australian? And I'm still not quite sure. You know, there's lots of designers doing their thing, which is using plants in you know, interesting ways. There's lots of, you know, one of my good friends, and I obviously have many, so I don't want to leave anyone out, but Sam Cox, Fiona Brockhoff, you know, Peter Shaw are all using plants in really interesting ways. And I think it's really refreshing that we can now start to use our palette, and I guess we're still using other ideas in terms of their shapes and forms and things, but that's going to come, you know. It's always the nicest thing about landscape and garden is it is evolving. You don't want, as your epitaph, I designed something that everyone else has designed, I just made it neater, or I just made it messier.
Mine grew better.
Yeah, I mean, you want to be able to explore a whole range of things.
I want to unpack this idea of the, you know, is an Australian, can you do an Australian garden without Australian plants? Mm. So are the plants synonymous with the actual design style? And I put to you that you could do a Japanese style garden without Japanese plants, using Australian architectural type of plants, you know, your kangaroo paws and your tree ferns and things like that, you could imitate. So looking at the Australian plants, you know, a lot of people think that some of the South African plants are Australian. We're looking at some of the Californian gardens, some of the plants that, you know, Mike Lucas and Thad Orr are using. You could almost say that's an Australian garden.
Totally. And it's really, you know, my first answer when the person asked me, you know, can you have an Australian garden without Australian plants? I said, of course you can, because it's about the aesthetics and you can,
feel,
you know,
people
say it's a Californian style.
The vibe of the thing.
I was wondering that because I guess I'm stepping into another area now, or another thought idea. You know, the big movement at the moment is around planting. You know, we've got very much a time where now plants people who might be nurserymen, you know, Piet Uldolf and others, are seen as these kind of guru people that are really influencing style. And so people have become much more attuned to having great planting. And I think that's great, because it's, you know, on the one hand, Piet is a nurseryman and he was making all these amazing, you know, patterns in his own garden, which was then translated through into public realm landscapes, and has been profoundly influential. And you've also got, you know, James Hitchmo's work in terms of seeding, you know, the amazing moat that I was lucky enough to see. Gosh, you know, London Bridge.
Tower of
London. I mean, it was so immersive. It was so beautiful. I just sat there and literally almost cried. I thought, oh, this is so beautiful. How does that translate to someone's garden? You know, not sure.
Or does it?
Then sometimes you need to have people who are those cutting edge and taking these extreme examples and really scientific approaches to landscape design to be able to then have the kind of common garden interest person be able to imitate what they can in a very manageable way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Michael McCoy put up a post about that, about what he might do for someone else is different than what he does for himself. And you have to be brave to experiment but also part of being a good designer is listening to what the client wants and what the client can do, what they have the means physically themselves to do, or what they have the means for someone else to do, and can they translate that. And it's a really important thing, you know, when... You know, for your listeners' benefit, we came in talking about how's gardening, you know, just at the start when we were chit-chatting away, and I was like, oh my God, I'm just about to die under Gora at the moment. You know, what I thought was a manageable problem is becoming my nightmare. And, you know, I personally, I can pull that out, I can do things, but you probably shouldn't have ever been put in by me, because that easy grow plant has been turned into
the
easy,
Triffid.
Yeah, the Triffid. And so I think some people get a little bit fooled when they read the labels on the, you know, nursery pot that says this is easy to grow. The question should be, does it spread?
Yes.
Or the wildflower meadow, which is so popular now. Mm. What's that really going to look like in our environment if you don't really know how things are going to balance out, and, you know, whether your environment is going to favour things, or whether there's birds that fly over regularly and drop seeds and you're just going to have a whole bunch of weeds.
Actually, can we talk about that? Because, you know, this huge following and huge fad, and I'm sure you're seeing this trend that's really generated from the UK and a number of the designers you've mentioned, and also in the US to an extent, is rewilding, meadowing, naturalistic planting. You know, it's so romantic and it's so beautiful in the right environment. But in Australia, we're really struggling with that because we don't have the same environment. We get a very weedy, dominant kind of takeover.
You've given me a wonderful opportunity to talk about Charlie Harper, who's coming to speak in Canberra on the 29th of February with a whole group of – it's a really, really great program. And I was saying I went to see NEP, the garden that Charlie is the head gardener at, and he's a really, you know, active proponent of the rewilding, but he's also a trained gardener as well, and he works with trained gardeners. And, you know, James Hitchmore, Nigel Dunnett, Tom Stewart Smith did the designs. You've got some of the world's top thinkers about it. So I think it's amazing to have Isabella Tree to fund that at a very old garden that's, you know, the croquet lawn now is this totally immersive space, and it's very beautiful. But it will be interesting to looking at the research that comes out about what has seeded too much, what do you call too much, what has escaped into the, you know, paddocks around. And I asked Charlie what actually is rewilding, and he said the gardener thinks of themselves or behaves as if they're the keystone species in that environment. So they're selecting what's doing the editing in and out, and their behaviour of digging, cutting, you know, cutting as in animals might graze that, is mimicking animal behaviour. And so you might look and think to one extent, and I know Monty, Don and others were saying rewilding is a fad, you know, we've always had gardens that have started Will Robinson. You just continue it through. It's a continuum. In terms of an eco warrior, I'd say go for it. But the other side of me also says, read a little bit about what it is rather than just head on into it.
Because with a packet of seeds.
Yeah, a lot of packets of seeds don't hurt anyone at all, but don't raise what you've already got, because you might be able to try and restore some of that and add elements of it, and then think about how you, because it is a whole ecological model. It's ecology and gardening in terms of the aesthetics, but the ecology of cutting, trimming, you know. And a couple of years ago, Claudia West gave a great presentation at the Australian Landscape Conference, which just stayed with me, and she said sometimes the worst thing that you can do is pull something out because it causes disturbance in the soil. Sometimes the best thing you can do is just cut the flowers off so they don't set seed, and it can save you a lot of work. And
there's
so
your Gowra problem.
Well, so I was actually thinking quite differently, though, because our native, we've got quite a unique, obviously, ecology in Australia. And obviously, the Indigenous people managed it with burning.
Mm.
So maybe our rewilding is not the same as in Europe, because it's such a different environment. And obviously, we deal with all the European weeds that have been imported as well. So, you know, maybe we do need to be thinking about these things in a quite different way to the way that they might be being dealt with elsewhere.
It's there's some really great research going on. There's a project in Canberra that the development at Jindarie are putting in that I haven't yet seen, that I'm hoping to look at, and it's about pollinator corridors and other things. But there's also some great work that's going on through the University of Melbourne and the Woody Meadows, which is looking at using natives in, you know, basically open space areas, and their management technique is to cut them back at different times. So they might be 1 year old. So you get this kind of mallee effect, and it's very foliferous because people love flowers, but it doesn't. And because of the density of it, of the regrowth, you don't tend to get as many weeds. So there's research going on out there. I think it's enormously important that our public works programs really start to think about how they, as you know, really important players in this field, don't just do block planting. It does disappoint me a lot that we don't think about the whole investment of planting something and having it as a weed or having it just die, and thinking how important the gardens and connections to nature are to us as a society.
Yeah. And with, you know, big conversation on climate change, of course. So are you seeing more of a kind of a push in that regard to be more aware of Mediterranean garden style?
Well, I think it's good to kind of define a Mediterranean garden. And generally, you know, they're, because someone the other day said to me, I want a Mediterranean style garden. I said, OK, what is that, you know? And so we're talking hummocky plants. We're talking, you know, less water, potentially woody, you know, woody yes. style Garrigue planting. It definitely is a style that I embrace. And then in, when I look at my salvias and some of the other, I mean, they're not in a native plant, as many of you listeners would know. They're not actually loving all this summer rain that we're getting. They're looking a little sad because normally they don't get summer rain. And you know, one of the extraordinary work going on is by a man called Olivier Philippe in the south of France, and who really has specialised in these Mediterranean-style gardens. And some of them are summer deciduous. Now, I don't know about you, but in Australia, we spend all our time, because we're just that little bit cooler. You know, we're not 48 degrees, we're 38 yes. degrees. And so these plants completely shut down. I mean, I thought one of the weirdest things ever that I saw when I was, you know, really quite young was a Kurrajong tree, but many of them are planted around Canberra, and also they're native to many parts of this area. And when they get stressed in summer, they're summer deciduous, and I kept thinking the tree was dead. But they're not good. I mean, they're great trees, but they mightn't be the perfect shade trees. And that's what I sometimes think about Mediterranean gardens, although I am totally in love with them personally. It depends. You've got to, you know, the stresses of your plant. And I certainly don't want people to think they have to do heaps of research by gardening. Anyone can garden. Anyone can grow anything. It's the most wonderful thing for people to do, because it teaches you, one, a lot about your own attentiveness and observation skills, but it also gives you just this opportunity for lifelong learning. You know, like there's never a time that I can, you know, that I don't sort of look at something and I go, oh, what if that happened? Why is that doing something? Why is that floppy? You know, the wonderful Attila that you had on the show a couple of probably months ago now, you know, I visited his wonderful garden, and I said to him, why is your whatever doing that? And he goes, because it's floppy, Fleur. And we both, because it was too wet. And I said to him, no one likes floppy plants in their garden, Attila. I said, you know, have a yell at it. But it's just, you know, getting the basics right, I think, is about drainage in a garden setting. And that comes back to ultimately what is the design intent, and thinking about what you want it to look like. And, you know, one of my very good, funny friends is, and he's so amazingly talented, Simon Rickard. He was at my garden one day and he said to me, what did you want it to look like? And I said, I actually don't know what I want it to look like.
You're a landscape architect. You cannot say that.
Except, but it's so true. I think your own garden is the hardest one to actually work out what's the concept.
Yeah, what is the concept? He was like, what were you trying to achieve? And I said, I don't know. I kind of just can't resist going past a nursery and trialing a plant. And I said, so I just have this, had this... you know, thing that, oh, yeah, this is going to work. And clearly it didn't, because Simon was, like, snooty about it for ages. He kept saying to me, oh, well, he didn't cave. He said it once and it burnt. He said, nice nature park look.
Oh. I'm glad it's not just me that can't go past a nursery as well.
But that's really, I think it's really interesting, because, you know, he started off the conversation saying that there's this real design trend about plants, that people are very planty now and really concentrating on plants. But we've ended, you know, we've come to this circle where we said, actually, if you don't get your design right, if you don't have a plan and think about the plants and the effects you want to achieve and then choose the plants, then you've got it all topsy-turvy. So how do we balance this?
It mightn't be topsy-turvy, because, you know, that's the whole cottage garden movement, isn't it? Put something, it'll flower, have something else. And, you know, the randomness of that is also really pretty interesting, because you sort of can think, see, you know, I don't want all spring flowering. Anyone can do spring gardens. You know, what's the seasonality? What's the extension that you want?
Yeah.
But I think in terms of what, you know, if you're going back to the real basics, what do you want to use the space for? How can you make it not so hard on yourself? Like, we will all age and we'll all get to a point that you don't really want to be out there 24/7.
Pulling out the gara.
Yeah, pulling out the gara. I know.
It's a tiller's job.
That and stashies are the bane of my life. You know, I'm just going to say this to your listeners. The closer you get to the most perfect plant for your garden, the closer it is to a weed, because
it does so well.
And I've learnt that 10 times over, but it still hasn't stopped me. And I think just thinking about the basics of what you want to get out of it. And if that's just you looking at a nice little patch of flowers, that's fine. But think about how to design it so it's slightly interesting, or go onto Instagram and have a little look at what people are doing. I do have this funny, kind of funny story to share about looks. My husband and I, we have bought a little house on the edge of where we live in Yass, and we're very proud, and we're doing it up as a 100% native garden. And my neighbour, I said, who's also got a bit of a native garden happening on the other side, I said, look, if you don't like gardening, I will garden for you on that side, because I really want to extend this and it will look really good. And I'm so happy that you have stuff that I can work with. And he looked at me and said, I'm ripping it out next week and I'm putting in cooch.
Oh, no.
So I was standing there going, trying to breathe. And I'm like, this is a true story. This happened to me this week. But it just did make me laugh that not everyone likes... Not everyone likes someone that loves plants. Like, some people actually don't love plants. They like a clean looking lawn.
True. One of the things that I was really keen to ask you, because you're so tapped into, you know, the sort of, I guess, who's up and coming and new designers and things. If you were to give advice or recommendations to people who are listening, who are not necessarily deeply into this environment of landscape design, who are the ones that are currently synonymous with sort of emerging trends?
It's a great question, but I'm not going to answer it directly by saying go to this person or go to that person, because I think that then just, it's always going to leave someone out. But I think if we're looking at what is of interest around the world at the moment, is how we can make gardening, and it sounds ridiculous, more sustainable. Mm. You know, we're big consumers of fertilizers, of imported soils, of all of those things. We're big wasters. Like, how many gardens and how many landscapes have you seen that are just ripped out and plants chucked away? So there is a definite need in the industry, I think, to look at ourselves and say, how can we be more sustainable as an industry? How can we have a lighter touch? Like, everyone thinks that gardening is green, and there's many areas of it that aren't green. Like, you know, in many places, the whole site is stripped bare of every plant. And then, because it's easier to do that and then work around plants, it costs more money. The drainage needs to be fixed and all of that. But alongside plants, there's also that idea of just having space to have something that grows, and people are going to live in apartments and all these other things. But I just genuinely think, you know, if you go back to what is happening, look at yourself and your own behaviours. You know, we are always lobbying to try to, you know, get a better outcomes, but just thinking about your own behaviours and how you can make that more sustainable, and also just learning about your own plants in your area and what's grown well and what hasn't grown well. You know, I had the fortune for some years of my life, you know, 4 or 5 years, to manage all the trees in Canberra's open space. And the thing that I was just amazed at is the foresight that went into the planting of Canberra. You know, in the first sort of in a period of time, there are like over 1 million trees planted in the inner north. There was regreening
around the 30s, 40s, sort of period?
Yep, works programs. Mm. So people coming back from the war, very depressed. Limestone Avenue is a testament to people that wanted to be recognised for being born in Australia. And it's standing today. And I think plants are there, trees are there for a long time. Give them a, you know, think a little bit about what you're doing. Don't just rip everything out. And, you know, the bird life, it sounds all glossy and green and things, but I do think these things are going to be very important. It's important to us as a civilization, but also just to us as individuals to kind of think about those things and our role that we can play. And I'm just going to, I know that we're probably over time and I'm giving another person a bit of a plug, but there's a wonderful lady who, that is coming to speak along with Charlie Harper, and her name is Emma Cutting. And it's a fabulous story because Emma is a music teacher. She's not a gardener at all. Well, now she is. And during COVID, she lived in Melbourne, inner city Melbourne, South Yarra, and, you know, they're allowed out 1 hour a day. So in Emma's 1 hour a day, she started making a tiny, weeny little garden outside her rented house. And then her neighbour, you know, made another one and another neighbour, and then the whole street all had these tiny little pocket gardens. And then around the corner they started this as well. So it was a bit of a COVID thing and they all had things in their windows. And then the council came along and said, it's all illegal. And, you know, I worked for the ACT government, so I know we've done things like that too. And she went to VCAT, and the other around the other corner was a barrister, and he defended her and all these residents, and they won. Their behaviour wasn't illegal.
What a great story.
And then it gets better because the University of Melbourne came in and said, well, you got the community engagement smack on, and so we will invest in that program. And they've made this 8-kilometre pollinator corridor made up of these tiny, weeny little gardens that aren't anything aesthetic. I mean, they look great. They're better than concrete. And they're trying to get microbats, little insects. They've got monitoring things on it. And Emma applied and was successful in winning a Meyer Foundation scholarship that's allowed her to continue to promote this work. And she's just a total jats cracker of a person that just through little bits of intervention has made this really big difference and brought on, you know, major researchers in this area. And I think that just shows the power of the individual.
This is what I'm really excited about coming up to the Landscapism conferences, and I want you to talk a bit more about those. And that is the way you find these innovative people, people like that who you don't necessarily think of as a great designer who's produced a glossy book, but someone who's been a real activist and has made a difference and has sort of brought on a whole, in a way, trend towards changing these things. So I guess just for our listeners, what is Landscapism Conferences, and what's the details, and what can they expect?
Expect a good time. So the Australian Landscape Conference, as you mentioned, is a biennial event, and it brings in, you know, groups of international and Australian landscape designers that are really doing the very top cutting edge work around the world. And in one of those invitations, I had invited Tom Stewart Smith and Sue Stewart Smith, who are just this very dynamic couple. Tom is a landscape architect, has designed probably the best well-known garden around the world is La Jardin Secret in Morocco. But he's got this amazing portfolio of work. And Sue is a very high achiever. She's studied literature, then she did, she's a doctor. Then she did psychotherapy and psychiatry and wrote a book called The Well-Gardened Mind, as much as anything because she wasn't a gardener and Tom was. And so to start thinking about what motivates him, how can I connect? So they were invited to the Australian Landscape Conference, and COVID kicked in and they couldn't come. And I've just kept that engagement open. And so they're coming to Canberra in the kind of off year. So this is the landscapism is the inter-year between the Australian Landscape Conference, and Tom and Sue, Georgina Reed and Stephen Wells are speaking in Sydney on the 24th of February, and then there is five people speaking on the 29th of February. So we have Professor Margot Neal, so she heads up the Museum of Australia, Tricia Dixon, author and writer, which many of your speakers probably know and see her wonderful posts. She's always got these amazing photographs. Charlie Harper from NEP, who I've mentioned, who's rewilding, Emma Cutting, and Dr. Sue Stewart-Smith, who will talk about therapeutic gardens and sort of, from a research perspective, what triggers are in our brain that, you know, attune us to nature. It's just two fascinating, events. And I'm just enormously proud that Tom and Sue are coming, because it's very hard to get to coax these, you know, great people to Australia. I know the weather's better, so it's a good time. And Tom has won the most gold medals at Chelsea ever. He's kind of like the Federer of the gardening world, and as with as much charm. And he is exhibiting this year at Chelsea as well. So he's hot-footing it back straight after coming to Australia. And then Sue's here for a little bit longer.
How wonderful. You know, that is such a great lineup of speakers. And I'm excited that you do the off year as well, because it keeps me going until I get to go to another Australian Landscape Conference. So thank you for what you do, for bringing these amazing, innovative speakers that we'd otherwise maybe not know about.
Thank you so much. It is, you know, some days with everyone's job, you think there are great days and you can certainly go, gosh, you know, it's hard when someone says, no, they can't come. But I just love the experience of people being there and the joy that it gives myself and others when you're listening to people, because it's people's life's work and they're proud, they're committed, they're enthusiastic, and they all just try to push that boundary a little bit and, you know, fall into an outlandish thing.
Wonderful. And I think that's, you know, where a lot of our listeners will really relate to is getting those little nuggets of inspiration. And so for listeners that want to buy tickets for the Canberra or Sydney events, where would they go?
To the Outlandish Ventures website, or you can go on Outlandish, if you just type that into Instagram, then there's a link there. I've dropped some brochures off around at some of the nurseries around Canberra, but probably best just to jump onto the website and join us. I really want the Canberra community. It's the first time it's been in Canberra, so I really want the Canberra community to come.
Fantastic. And I'm going to ask the last question, because we could talk about this forever, Fleur. But lastly, do you have any advice that you'd like to share with enthusiastic garden designers?
Well, it's actually something that's going to sound completely off key here, you know, when they're starting. But in a couple of weeks, I'm interviewing, slightly overwhelmed by the invitation, Paul Bangay, and he's got his gorgeous new book out. And I am so impressed by Paul himself, because he's got, you know, Australia's most well-known designer. But he just looks to others, looks at what other people do, you know, not a copier. He assesses. And I think that's just a great lesson in life, whether you love his designs, whether you don't love his designs. It's something that I think is a lovely attribute for, well, not lovely, it's a very valuable attribute, just to have a look and then assess it of how that fits into your psyche, your thinking, your way of doing that. And to look at what other people are doing is just an absolute privilege, because many people are happy to share.
I think that's a great way to close up, because this podcast is all about sharing. And so it's really about sharing that inspiration, ideas. And thank you so much. And Sachi and I are both so excited to come to your events. And I'm sure many of our listeners will be inspired to sign up now and come and join us.
Thank you so much. It's been just an absolute joy to come. And I just commend you on doing your podcast. I just think, gosh, you know, you put time and effort into it. It's we as listeners just are able to sit back and, you know, sometimes I feel, oh, I don't have time to do a podcast. And I think, what about the people making them? Like, they make time. So it's just, it's great that you go out and do it. You know, your listener group is growing and growing. And I hope you also feel the joy that they feel in listening to them.
We have so much fun doing this, Fleur. I'm going to wrap up there, but don't forget to follow us on Instagram, find us on Facebook, and also follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And we will talk to you in a couple of weeks again with our next exciting episode. Thanks, everyone.
Bye then.